This is really exciting. I'm so happy to see everybody here. We'll say who's here in just a second, because we're all in Nick Sturm's office. Actually, maybe let's do this, like a mini roll call first.
Yeah, I'm here. Nick?
Yeah, that's Nick.
Andrew's here also. Happy 2018.
Yeah, I feel really good about 2018. It hasn't started well, necessarily, but I think we only have up to go from here. I'm Tobias Wilson Bates, and I don't even know who's a guest and who's a host at this point, but our guest host?
I guess host.
Our host guest?
Yeah.
We are crushing 2018 already.
Really.
Say your name.
Oh, yeah, I'm Anna Ionis, and this is like the first year that I haven't done that thing where you keep writing the old date. I think my mind and my heart have been waiting for 2018 for so long that it just, like, my hand has followed.
That's interesting you say that, because I noticed that the other day, because I did it once, but I'm really bad. I'm, like, normally, like, through May doing the, like, previous year, but I've been pretty good about it so far. I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
I'm Nick Sturm.
And this is The Office Hour.
I thought we would do a podcast on technology and education, broadly speaking. And the reason I say this is because, since Nick noted the other day that most of our podcasts are monstrously depressing, I thought, This is potentially the most depressing thing in education. Taking the sort of Luddite stance of recognizing that there are technologies that could, inefficiently, but in ways that potentially make monetary sense, replace us. These are the technologies that replace people with higher degrees, that stand in front of classrooms and talk to students. And there have been a lot of attempts at this already. There's a lot of money in things like Coursera. Khan Academy got picked up in all kinds of ways, and institutions are looking for ways to not only take advantage of all the free education that's out there, but also potentially trim some money on how many people you need in front of a room of students. Just the other day, I listened to an interview with somebody doing this thing called the Minerva Academy. I don't know if you've heard of this.
Yeah, I applied for a job there.
Me too.
Unsurprisingly, I haven't heard anything.
And so this is directly where we are right now in this moment, where how much of the things that we might spend, 8 to 10 or however many years of our lives acquiring certain kinds of knowledge and pedagogical training, is mechanically reproducible. Making us relatively useless. So
you sound a little unsure about the rise.
That's why I thought I'd bring Anna in, because I think she does know something.
Well, I've been teaching a class with a big online component this past semester, and I'm doing it this semester, so I'm kind of wading into the waters of online teaching. Very much just dipping my toe in it, because my classes are about 50% online and then 50% they look like a traditional writing seminar. And I also think the writing classroom is a little bit of a unique space for these questions, because, like, you know, when we think of, like, online teaching, we do think of Coursera or MOOCs, and, you know, what you do is, like, go onto a website as a student, go onto a website, watch a terrible video and then take a quiz on it. Well, when you teach writing, like, one of the best ways to improve writing is to write more. So when we're online, most of what my students are doing is writing, reading each other's work, doing research, workshopping. It's very kind of traditional. That has allowed me to be a little bit more of an optimist about the possibilities of new technologies, new educational technologies, but it's very much bracketed by the circumstances of Georgia Tech, of the kinds of students that we teach, and of writing pedagogy, too.
I also have a little bit of experience with online teaching. I'm actually young enough that when I took AP Language Literature in high school, it was an online class.
Oh, wow.
And funnily enough, I got a C in it because, you know, despite the fact that I went on to get a PhD in English, I was the kind of student in high school that kind of needed to, like, be told to do work. And so that because there was no one there to tell me, like, I never did any of it. Mm-hmm. And then later in graduate school for the University of Minnesota, I taught, like, upper division, like, literature surveys online for a couple of years. And one thing I noticed in those was a kind of similar thing that I've never really seen before in my teaching experience, where I had, like, a kind of, like, 50-50 balance in terms of the students that, like, totally excelled and, like, got A's, and then the students that, like, got D's or, like, failed the class straight up. So I'm wondering, like, how, like, in teaching a hybrid class, how crucial is that hybridity of it for you in your experience? Like, do you think it would work as well if it were a totally 100% online thing, as opposed to, like, you being in town periodically and seeing and meeting with your students face to face?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would work if it were totally online, or at least, like, I don't know what that would, that would be a very different course.
Sure.
Right? Like, yeah, and when I was, like, planning the class, one of my students, I was talking to former students in a traditional face-to-face class and saying, like, I'm doing this, you know, I'm doing this thing, I'm adapting the class you have just taken for this hybrid format. Like, I solicited some experiences from the students, and they were like, be wary, you know, exactly what you just described. Like, it's really hard to stay involved and to feel like you're really taking a class, right? And Adeline Coe has written about this as well, like saying this is a great, online is a great structure for writing classes because it moves so much of the information into text, right? So students just have to write a lot more, and that helps them write better, but with the big caveat that it's only if they do it, right? So mm-hmm. I think, like, now I still really rely on certain kinds of traditional modes of, I guess, like, of enforcement or encouraging buy-in, you know, whichever way you want to put it, through an interpersonal kind of just, they have a sense of obligation to me because they know me. And the inverse of that too, right? Like, I can provide support that comes in a conversational model that I would have to learn whether there even are other ways to do that if it were totally online, right?
Sure.
I mean, like, I do, like, if I'm away, like, if we're having an online day, I do hold office hours with students through Google Hangouts. So there's, like, the screen is dividing us, but there's a kind of sense of, like, you know, human connection there. And in fact, like, I don't know, I'm really interested in the ways, like, those sort of translations from traditional to hybrid or traditional to online kind of highlight and throw up the imbricated nature of online teaching and face-to-face teaching and sort of the fuzzy boundaries and, like, what it means to be, like, connected to another person as, like, a pedagogical practice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what I'm thinking of, for example, is, like, when Google Hangouts doesn't work very well and I FaceTime with a student instead, right? Like, that's kind of not something I would be... That would never happen in a traditional face-to-face class, but,
mm-hmm.
like... that sense of having to work through a technical snafu can create other kinds of connection that are useful pedagogically. I think greater independence that my students had in the class created stronger connections between the students themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But they also, this is a residential school, they live together, most of them are about the same age, et cetera, et cetera. There are all these kinds of contingencies. I mean, we think of, in some ways, the move towards online as a kind of democratizing move, but it may well be that the people who can succeed in that format are set up to succeed in a more traditional format as well. But I don't know enough about that to say whether that's true.
Yeah, and what you're describing about holding office hours through Google Hangout or FaceTime, I mean, I emphasize that too. Like, I would never do that in a normal traditional class, but I was wondering how you make it not feel like Dr. Ionis customer service time.
Troubleshoot my paper.
Well, it's more troubleshoot my paper at that point because, like, one of the ways, and I don't think this is a totally bad thing either, actually, like, one of the ways that I have adapted a face-to-face course for online is kind of to up the workload that they can do on their own or with partners. So, like, kind of more robust writing that I ask them to do and more robust research, like in terms of whether that's in terms of page count or what have you, right? So as we move through this semester, more of what they're doing is working on a project, and it's kind of fine that that they talk to me about that project, right? Like,
just that would be a fear of mine entering into that space online, because we're so used to like that, like a troubleshooting mentality, and like risking the loss of that interpersonal kind of like commitment to you as their teacher and instructor, and you know, guiding them through a project, and like the potential loss of that. But it's interesting, like upping the ante for them so that they become more invested without you having to be there 100% of the time.
Yeah, because I think there are ways, like, I'm sure there are lots of caveats to what I'm about to say as well, but like there are ways in which like the nature of the digital platforms can build in other kinds of accountability and buy-in that I think enhance some of that intrinsic motivation. I had my students publish their writing on the internet too, so they wanted it to be good, you know, and accurate and thorough and responsible. And so I think that since it, like, the buy-in came less from my charisma and more from the sense of the stakes, a project that had stakes.
Although I imagine your charisma was pretty good, too.
Well, I mean,
It's interesting, a thing you said, because I do think that this is really fascinating, and maybe we could balance this with what Andrew was saying earlier, which is that I am always trying to get my students to be okay with doing more work. Years ago, I was coaching a rowing team, and I was asking the coach who I was taking over from, which are the fun drills? And she was like, whichever ones you tell them are fun, just make them row until they're good at rowing. This idea that, like, you're just in a boat, you're just going to move the oar, just try to make them do it for as many hours as possible, and they'll be as good as, like, they get time doing that. And I feel like the same is true of writing, especially in these, like, early classes. They just need to, you know, write 10 or 20,000 words
to
get a sense
read.
Of... Yeah, right? Those reflexive skills. And at Georgia Tech, where the students are incredibly stressed and incredibly driven... That seems to be more of a kind of gambit there. It's like, what are their expectations? What can you get them to go along with? How do they balance this against their other workload? This sort of thing. Whereas it sounds like in Andrew's experience, which is a different kind of thing, the expectations of a group of students at perhaps lower state colleges or community colleges, it's a question of just getting them to personally invest in that space. And in that way, like, the retrenchment seems really dangerous, that there's the possibility of students who would already have completed a course maybe now get better version of that course, or maybe we're able to push their expectations to increase their skills, but students who are already, you know, kind of on the fringes just drop right off.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's the other side of, like, the medium kind of being the message, is that I think there's something in the structure of online classes that can really obscure the value of what the students are going to get out of it in the end, right? Like, it's a credential instead of a experience or even just a project or something like that. I don't know.
Looking at online courses, it also seems to, like, reperpetrate some of the worst sins of academia in that, like, the most attended courses are courses with big names, and those big names might not actually be good teachers, or they might be teaching material that, like, you don't need, you know, 3 million people looking at, sort of thing, that... People who are actually investing time and intimacy and charisma in their pedagogy don't show up in that ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they're different things. Like, we were talking about Modpo a little bit before, I guess before we started recording. Like,
and Modpo is the University of Pennsylvania Modern and Contemporary American Poetry class, a 10-week fully online course with TAs that webcast weekly, things like that.
I think sounds like you know more about it than I do, Nick. But, like, there are some... circumstances in which, like, I mean, different people have different reasons for taking all kinds of classes, right? And, like, those, not everybody needs to get, like, some people are going to already have the buy-in because they're interested in modern poetry, and they don't need to have some sort of measurable result of what they get out of it.
I mean, Modpo, for example, is unique because it's a 10-week course that doesn't line up with a semester necessarily, and it's free for everyone. You can take it anywhere in the world. And it's not necessarily tied to students at the University of Pennsylvania. If you happen to be there, that's great, but it's not something that's specific to Georgia Tech, for example. It's not like an 1102 class that students are taking 50% online and 50% in person. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a different, it's a different buy-in.
Yeah, and there's not that expectation that mm-hmm. students have met X, Y, and Z learning outcome and, mm-hmm. you know, in this measurable way. Or I'm rambling a little bit, but, like, that strikes me as a
on this podcast? No way.
But that strikes me as kind of a crucial piece at the heart of these questions that doesn't get talked about that much in relationship to, like, the online revolution is... It, like, one of the things that's at the heart of it is, like, what are we assessing and what does it mean to assess? Like, there was an, did y'all see that there was a piece in the Chronicle the other day about assessment? Did mm-hmm. you read that, Andrew?
Yeah.
And it, I think, really wisely says, like, there are some measurements that actually give us useful knowledge and there are lots of other measurements that don't give us any useful knowledge. And I think sort of implicitly this author was suggesting that the measurements that are valued when we're looking at technology and teaching are not good ones.
I'm curious about how hybrid teaching affects your public-private divisions between yourself and your students. For instance, like, I am pretty okay with students being aware of my online existence to a certain extent. Right? Like, I use Twitter in my classes a lot because I discovered that, like, as opposed to having a course website or something that requires a lot of, like, maintenance and front-end, like, development, if there are just things that I want to throw at my students and have them look at if they're interested, Twitter's a great place to do that because you come up with a hashtag, you're like, oh, look, here's a thing that isn't required, but if you're interested in this, watch this video or read this or whatever. Whereas things like Facebook or Instagram or whatever, that for me is very private. And, like, maybe if you're not my student anymore and you request to be my friend on Instagram or whatever, I'll let you do it. But definitely not while I'm your teacher, right? I would imagine that the fact that you are interacting largely with your students online affects those boundaries to a certain extent. Has that been your experience?
Well, I wasn't thinking about that much until you asked that question. In some ways, I actually think the hybrid structure kind of formalized public-private boundaries a little bit.
That's
more.
What I was wondering.
Yeah. And in fact, like, the semester when, like, it hasn't been any hybrid semesters when students have, like, tried to friend me on Facebook during class or anything like that, right? Yeah. And in fact, like, there are times when I'm kind of more explicitly available. Like, I mean, I'm often meeting with students or with small groups of students for kind of digitally interfaced small seminars during class, but I'm also, like, available through a Piazza chat function, that kind of thing, kind of crowdsourced but also instant feedback. But they know when that is, right? It's all during the class period, it's during their office hours. Like, there are kind of more explicit rules or spaces, digital spaces, where I'm more available. So I think it kind of allays that a little bit. And in fact, I do think, like, in a good way, like, when you think about public-private distinctions, the immediate thing I thought about was just sort of my interiority. Uh-huh. And I do think, like, in a way that was good for my research and maybe even good for my teaching, last semester I felt less kind of subsumed by the classroom and by being, like, kind of enmeshed in a teaching experience. You know, people have talked about kind of the politics of the online classroom as a way of, like, increasing access for non-traditional students and that kind of thing, but, like, thinking about the gender politics of academic labor, there's a way in which, like, one of the premises of today is that it's mostly bad for academic labor, but I think you can carve out other kinds of resources when you teach online too.
If your students all access class through their computers and you access the class through your computers, can you have a snow day?
Well, we had no class for the hurricane last semester. And the day's, like, announcement with all the guidelines and stuff just said, like, no class. We're, you know, I replicated that, right? Even though we could have had class. But that was a little bit sticky in particular because, like, there was a question about, like, whether they would have internet and stuff like that. Right,
yeah.
Like,
a hurricane in particular. Yeah. But, you know, the snow seems like something. You could let the students know that they can never have a snow day again.
They can never have a snow day. Well, it does raise new questions about, like, attendance policies and that kind of thing and kind of different negotiations and, like, questions about what it means to attend the class, right? Like, is doing the work attending the class?
Well, I'm curious about that maybe more broadly. Like, have there been any realizations that you've had doing hybrid teaching that upset a certain, you know, expectation of teaching as it was developed through, you know, going to an actual space and teaching there in person for so many years, that has rendered that to seem kind of like irrelevant or absurd or something like that? Like are there things that we do in quote unquote regular traditional teaching that now seem kind of weird or make you wonder why we do that to begin with now that you've approached it from this different way? How does it work in your class? Do your students, I mean, obviously when you're here and they come to class, they're interacting with each other in the classroom some of the time, but do you design assignments such that they do that when you're not around? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So
there
still is some, like, basic sense of a non-digital community.
Yes.
In your class.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, and I structure the class, so just a little logistics. I do kind of longer chunks of time, kind of on-off. So first 2 weeks of class, traditional, face-to-face, and then, like, 2 weeks online. And the online sessions are designed to map with the kind of high point of their labor on individual major projects. I design the day-to-day logistics of those online days so they can be a little bit asynchronous. They always have, like, deadlines for kind of evidence to produce of their work at, like, midnight at the end of class. But across each of those chunks of online time, the required infrastructure that they meet face-to-face, it starts very strong and it kind of gets a little more loosey-goosey in a way that I kind of don't need to care about whether they're meeting, whether they sit to... So the first time we, like, go online, and it occurred to me today that I might switch the terminology in the future if I continue to do this, from online days to independent work days or something like that, because I think the online thing confuses students, sets them up for a different expectation than what we actually do. So when we go online for the first time, students will be in a group of five that they'll stay with the whole semester. And that's something that carries over from my face-to-face classes as well, just a kind of a workshop group, peer evaluation group, that kind of thing. And I will schedule a meeting with each of those groups of five for one point during that day. So, like, my day will be filled as though I'm going to classes in a traditional way, but the students will encounter me on Google Hangouts once over those 2 weeks or whatever, 2.5 weeks. And so they'll be sitting in a room together, five students. They'll have one of the students' essays that they workshop, and I have set up, like, guidelines that require them to first write in response to the essay under review, then to speak, then to strategize, like, a plan of action for the author. And then when I'm meeting with them, it replicates. They'll be writing about the graphic novel adaptation of Kindred. So our meetings replicate seminar-style discussion. And in fact, that tends to go kind of better in some ways than, like, trying to do discussion with our classes of 20 or 25. Often in those very well equipped but kind of too big classrooms where you can't really, if you get everybody in a circle, they can't hear each other, that kind of thing. Like, I actually think there's something to your point about community, having to kind of huddle in and look at me on the laptop isn't all bad for creating a sense of buy-in and,
sure,
and community, right? So that's the kind of thing that I try to do to, like, use the digital tools to facilitate some of the things that can't be replaced by or measured according to the norms of the big machines that are coming to take our jobs.
I was about to say, and this really doesn't sound like a machine stealing job. It's not like you do less work.
Yeah.
It's not like they could replace seven of you with one you who can use this technology.
Mm-hmm.
You do the exact same amount of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
The students possibly do more work. And so it's a different kind of interaction, but it's not an efficiency in the way that, like, you know, cutting jobs and scaling up machinery is an efficiency most of the time in the corporate world.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think I could give you my class website and you could just go run it in some sort of, well, you mm-hmm. could, any of you could.
Yeah. For our listeners, she was pointing out Nick.
Yeah.
But people who study, who write about hybrid teaching have talked about this as well. Like, the kind of front-end development is so high, but, like, the flexibility is really, like, you have to be really flexible and responsive, too. And I do think, like, that's one thing that has been the same and different between, like, traditional classes and a hybrid class. Like, you know, if students are interested in some sort of tangent that we go off of in a seminar, you know, I'll try to, like, kind of bring in a text that speaks to it more directly in the next class. But instead of maybe throwing that up on a screen in front of them, now I write a blog post for the day's assignment that also has to convey in writing why I'm showing it to them. I like the way you can kind of concretize the intertextual nature of when we're talking about Octavia Butler or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And that was like poetry. Concretize the intertextual nature.
Or jargon.
No, well, I mean, it's a good thing we don't have a poet in the room.
Yeah.
Are you convinced that this is a good thing for education now, Toby? Or how do you feel?
I feel better. This is what I will say, and I think this actually speaks to another one of these, like, weird academic sins. That academics, in most, so far as I can tell, PhD, MFA, MA programs, don't actually receive particularly thorough, rigorous, or intentional training in their pedagogy. They often have, like, one pedagogy seminar, maybe one semester of someone overseeing their initial kind of... And this is really what I thought about the poetry thing. I didn't mean to be BSing that. You actually have to kind of articulate the reason and the shape of your decision making. So it's not just walk in front of them and it's like, oh, okay, I read Octavia Butler 3 years ago, what do I say? But rather, like, this is the shape of this. This is how we'll interact. This is what I want you to have.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you've only been doing this for, like, a semester and change now, but how do your students react to this initially? Are they prepared for it? Are they used to it? Is it strange to them?
I mean, I think it confuses them initially.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, I feel like I notice this kind of thing more. It's hard to read their response, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, we all, like, it's like, hello,
sure.
I asked you a question.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell what they think about the class because I don't think they always know that that's the kind of class it's going to be when they walk into my class, right? So I'm like, guess what? And a lot of the feedback I got by the end of the semester was that they really liked the structure. I don't know what that actually tells us in terms of important questions to ask about education, but, like, I mean, this is a problem of any kind of teaching experience. I think it takes them a while to get used to, like, moving between different digital tools, and, like, I feel like as much as I've tried to streamline that piece of things, it's still, like, today in class, I was like, okay, you know, you're gonna start by downloading this from Google Drive, and then you're gonna create the page on Mahara, and then you'll submit it onto Canvas. But guess what? Y'all were all doing that too, right?
Sure.
Like, yeah. So that takes a little getting used to. And, like, the big thing that I've tried to do with the sort of 50% hybrid, 50% face to face, 50% online, is I've tried to kind of make the daily structure of the class look as much the same whether we're in person or online. Which also means that we use computers a lot more in the class, too. And that's something, it's like a total technology free-for-all zone in my classroom now. Like,
yeah.
I don't even try, like, when I think back to myself, like, trying to regulate phones on desks now, I just don't even worry about that anymore.
Well, so this is maybe a kind of unfair question, but if, you know, your wife, your husband is in Chicago, your students are in Atlanta, if not for the kind of geographical necessity of approaching classes this way, would you do it anyway?
I've had to think about that question because I've anticipated being asked it.
Sure.
I have to, like, have a good answer for it. The reason it even occurred to me to do this was because of like personal life stuff, but I would be excited to do it again, actually. I like it. And I think, I actually do think my students' work last semester was some of the strongest I've had since I've been at Georgia Tech. They were much better. The thing that I noticed, I mean, this isn't scientific or anything at this, you know, the thing that I noticed is how much better they were at using a clear and consistent vocabulary to make connections between like what they had to do and what I was trying to teach them. And in fact, to make connections between kind of the lessons of writing and rhetoric that I wanted to teach them and our course theme, which is about contemporary portrayals of transatlantic slavery, right? So I wanted them to think about the politics of looking and visual culture, the politics of literacy and textuality, academic spaces as ones that can reproduce and hopefully undermine white supremacy and that kind of thing. And like, they were making explicit in language some of those connections more than I have seen students in the past. And I guess I chalk that up to like my having had to put them in language more, language that persists, right? Like that they can go back and look at on a website instead of like probably not write down when one of their classmates in seminar says something brilliant.
Well, yeah, and hey, whether it's the technology or not, I think the novelty of approaching a class this way has clearly kind of forced you to reconsider some of your assumptions and procedures in teaching a class, mm-hmm. and doing that kind of, like, reflection and reconsideration is never a bad thing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's neat to have, like, a more concrete archive of the class, too, on, because, like, our class basically lives on a WordPress blog. So like every day I write a new blog post and the students always comment on it as part of their, like I count that partly towards class participation and attendance. So yeah, it's all there in one place. And also a lot of it's not there, right? Like
right.
I'm also like not seeing the students as much. So that's one thing that was really different was like releasing some of that sense of like, I should kind of know what they really think about the class or what they're really talking about. But like a year ago in a class, like we were trying to have a conversation about something, right? Something a little bit, it related to class politics in some way, but I don't remember what it was. And it was just going nowhere. And I was like, I left. I was like, y'all, I'm going to leave for 15 minutes and you talk because you seem uncomfortable because I'm here. And, like, afterwards, they were like, that was great, right? So I feel like this is making me sound good. just left them.
I'm gonna do that.
Yeah, but like, they're not baby ducklings.
Yeah.
But
so
like,
you left the room once, then you
and
left
now
the state.
Yeah. I just really carried it forward.
I think we did it. I think we solved all our problems and questions.
Yeah, just leave.
Yeah. Don't worry, podcast listeners.
I'm out of here.
Oh, no.
Office Hour is a production of the Britton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at Georgia Tech. For more information, visit us on the internet at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening!